journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 12th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
What is the Trans-Pacific Partnership and why is it being discussed in secret? A new film, Five Broken Cameras, documents firsthand the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the big squeeze, a social and political history of the controversial mammogram.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A series of highly secretive meetings are taking place in Leesburg, Virginia this week between the United States and eight other Pacific Rim countries. The negotiations concern a trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which would, according to Bloomberg, create the biggest trade zone in U.S. history. With an agenda focused on furthering corporate interests, the trade negotiations have had virtually no involvement from any public groups, although 600 pro-business lobbyists have been given passwords to view online versions of the negotiations. Amnesty International, the Sierra Club, the AFL-CIO, and are among many public interest groups that have voiced serious concerns over the issues being covered in the negotiations, and over 130 members of Congress have signed a letter calling for more transparency. Most of the public's knowledge about what is being drafted in the TPP has come from leaked documents. Analysis of these documents show how the TPP may possibly limit the production of generic drugs and affect free speech on the internet. The closed-door talks could also potentially move more American jobs overseas, as well as allow foreign corporations to appeal to an international tribunal rather than subject themselves to U.S. laws. While legislators in Japan are reluctant to join the TPP, Canada and Mexico will become part of the group starting next month, and China is currently deciding whether or not to join the group. U.S. officials are promising a public comment period and a congressional review once the talks are complete. Joining me on the phone is Lori Wallach, director and founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome to Uprising, Lori.
Hello. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump off in just a few moments, but I will be turning it over to my campaign director on TPP, Melinda St. Louis, because I'm in the thick of the talks, and I have negotiators coming up actually asking to talk with me. So please start.
Well, tell us how you describe the TPP to our audience who may have never heard of this.
The TPP is not really about trade. It's comprised of 26 chapters. The U.S. would be required to conform all of its federal and state law to these chapters, which constrain financial regulation, require us to import food that doesn't meet our safety standards, would subject us to international corporate tribunals where domestic laws could be challenged outside of our courts. And I am going to have to jump off, and here is our campaign director, Melinda St. Louis.
Welcome, Melinda.
Hello, thank you.
Tell us exactly, actually, what Lori is doing.
Well, she's just been approached by one of the lead negotiators from one of the TPP countries who would like to talk with her about some of the issues that are being negotiated. So it's really we provide both technical assistance to some of the negotiators as well as to educate the public about what this agreement may mean.
And what do you mean by technical assistance to the negotiators? Aren't the negotiators the folks who are actually discussing this in secret?
Yes, they are negotiating in a secret. We do not have access to the text. We stand outside of the negotiations in order to try to provide whatever input we can without having access to it. So that's why we know the little that we do know is from talking to people around the sidelines. However, there are 600 corporate advisors who have complete access to the text. They have the passwords to be able to actually comment and to be a part of the process, whereas civil society organizations and organizations in the public interest do not.
Now, the negotiators, I understand, are actually country representatives, right? But then you've got these business lobbyists who can weigh in?
Yes. Yes. The negotiators are government officials from each of the TPP countries. The lobbyists are not in the room with them. They just have access. The U.S. has the U.S. Trade Representative's Office has a process of for cleared corporate advisors to be able to comment on the text and to have access to it.
Now, which are the countries that are involved? I mean, if this is a Trans-Pacific Partnership, it includes Pacific Rim countries, but also the U.S. and very soon Mexico and Canada?
That is correct. There are, with Canada and Mexico joining soon, there will be 11 countries that are part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks. Malaysia, Vietnam, Brunei, Singapore, and Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Peru, Chile, and the United States are all have been part of these talks. But importantly, it also is intended to be what they call a docking agreement, which means that any country in the Pacific Rim, if they agreed to the rules after they're negotiated, could join. So Japan has expressed interest, though there's a lot of at the official level, though there's a lot of opposition in Japan. Other Asian countries as well, and including the U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk has actually said he would love nothing more than for China to be a part of the TPP eventually. So we are really looking at an agreement or a deal that if it comes into effect would affect up to 40% of the globe. So it actually is much more far-reaching than the countries that are negotiating now, though they are the ones who are going to set the rules for the rest of those who may eventually join.
Who is allowed to actually contact the negotiators? Bloomberg is reporting that Friends of the Earth, along with groups like General Motors and Ford Motor Company and Chrysler, have been allowed to make presentations at the secret meeting.
They have a. There was a stakeholder of 3 hours on Sunday. At the beginning of the talks, they had an opportunity for a stakeholder presentations. Each were allowed up to 10 minutes to make presentations. There was also tabling. This only happened where stakeholders could have tables. And again, this is. So negotiators were able to come. Unfortunately, the way that it was set up, there were only 18 chairs per room, and many of the negotiators said that they actually weren't even able to get into the presentations, even though they were interested in hearing them. So while we did participate in that and think that it's important to try to engage however we can, it is vastly less than what is needed in order to actually have true public debate, and particularly because the text is secret. And so all of the input that we're able to give is only based on the leaked. There actually have been some texts that have leaked, and that's where we see a very discouraging direction of the negotiations in terms of potentially increasing medicine prices through extending drug patents of pharmaceutical companies so that generic drug companies cannot compete, and so that would increase drug prices. And for people living with HIV and AIDS around the world, this could actually be a death sentence. We have seen concerns about the copyright provisions, which would increase the policing of the internet and to reduce internet freedom. There's a lot of concern around what this could mean for wages and environmental standards around the globe, and also major concerns. There was a chapter in leaked about investment, which would empower corporations to be able to attack consumer safety, environmental protection, and public health laws in foreign tribunals. So all of the things that we're seeing are very concerning, and we also have been arguing that it's incredibly important that if this is going to be an agreement that supposedly be for the 21st century, as they're claiming, that there must be public input and actually a real public debate, which is what has not happened up until this point.
Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, speaking yesterday at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Russia, said this free trade agreement is central to America's economic vision in Asia. By reducing market distortions and leveling the playing field, the TPP will raise the bar for competition in a way that benefits every economy in the region, whether it is an active partner in the TPP or not. I mean, of course, this sounds similar to promises made during NAFTA negotiations. How do you respond?
Well, this is always the line that is parroted when in talking about these trade deals. But what's important, I think, is what Lori Wallach said right at the outset, which is that these deals are actually they are touted as trade deals. But of the 29 chapters that are being negotiated here, only 2 of them actually have to do with trade, and actually have to do with what you would think of in terms of tariffs or in goods and services. The rest are about actually extending corporate power through the back door of ways that they aren't able to get it through our democratic system. But it's also very important to note that even on the trade data for the United States, that you look across the board with these trade deals with NAFTA, now recently the Korea U.S. free trade agreement. And actually, while exports may increase a little bit, imports in the United States have increased by much more. So when you look at the net, it's actually a net job loss for the United States. And I think that it's actually very disingenuous when our government officials try to tout these as job-creating agreements, because they absolutely are not.
And this is based on the fact that because many of the countries that would be part of this partnership have perhaps weak labor laws, also very much lower costs of living than in the U.S., lower salary levels than in the U.S., and so goods could be produced far cheaper, obviously in countries like China, which is still considering whether or not to join the TPP. That's already happening with China, but even countries, other countries in this group, versus the United States. That economic pressure simply sends jobs overseas, right?
Well, that's absolutely true, but then it actually encourages offshoring even more when they put in these provisions, like what I mentioned in terms of the investment provisions, that allows foreign investors the opportunity to go to foreign tribunals to attack laws that they think affect their expectations of profit. So for corporations that go overseas to a country that may have weak laws and so forth, if the country decides to pass an environmental provision to actually protect their water supply or something like that, the corporation can actually sue the country for compensation in foreign tribunals. And so all of the risk that corporations take when they offshore, they actually want to get rid of all of that risk. And so that in and of itself actually increases the probability that corporations will actually take their jobs offshore when they don't have to worry about any changes in the regulatory framework in those countries. And so you're absolutely right that in terms of just the basic economics of the race to the bottom in terms of wage and working conditions is a concern, but then you also see these additional giveaways to corporations that choose to offshore jobs in these agreements. Hmm.
Well, I'm wondering how this agreement is being viewed outside the United States, because not only, of course, could American jobs be lost, but these sorts of agreements do have the potential to worsen working conditions in poor nations. There was an editorial in freemalaysiatoday.com about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, called America's Hidden Agenda. And their analysis is that it's all about China. I'll quote, "It appears that the whole idea of the TPP was born out of U.S. contempt for the Chinese economic rise in Asia and in the world. Hence, to stem the rise of the most populated nation on earth, the Americans want the entire Asian bloc to join them in, quote, killing China economically." How do you agree with that assessment, or is there any grain of truth in that?
Well, as I mentioned, the U.S. Trade Representative himself has said that he would love nothing more than for China to actually eventually be a part of TPP. So what you see is kind of the officials talking out of two sides of their mouths. On one hand, I think to try to sell this to the American public, they are pushing the idea that this is a way to contain China, but the U.S. corporations that are behind much of the TPP actually very much want China to be a part of it. So I wouldn't agree completely with that analysis, though I do think that there is some sense of that is some of the political posturing that's used, for example, in the U.S. Congress to try to sell this, to say that this is a way to try to contain China, when in fact it's really a way, the eventual plan is to see China's markets as an opportunity for U.S. corporations.
Hmm. Now, these documents that are the working draft of the agreement have been in negotiations for a number of years, 5 years, I understand. The negotiations began in 2007. They're still being kept secret from the public. Earlier, when I mentioned that Mexico and Canada are about to join the TPP, do you see this agreement as a major expansion of NAFTA? And how would it sort of supersede NAFTA?
Well, those are very good points. Actually, the United States has been a part of these negotiations for about 3 years. It initially started between actually just a couple of the Pacific Rim countries themselves, and then the United States joined to kind of make it more of the kind of the TPP that it is today as it's being negotiated. But yes, indeed, we were actually considering this a NAFTA on steroids even before we saw Canada and Mexico agreeing to join, and now that characterization is even more appropriate. Canada and Mexico, as part of the U.S. Canada and Mexico, is the North America Free Trade Agreement, but this would in many ways supersede. It's actually quite complex because there are actually free trade agreements between many of the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries already, and so that's part of the complexities of this negotiation is seeing where the TPP would supersede some of the other trade agreements. Those who are behind TPP, the corporations that are very much pushing for this, intend to be able to achieve through TPP things that they were not able to achieve through some of these bilateral negotiations and with NAFTA. And so obviously some of the quote-unquote 21st century issues that they're talking about in terms of internet, some of the electronic commerce that wasn't actually part of, was actually even happening during NAFTA and some of these other agreements when they were negotiated, it's an attempt to try to lock down for corporations these new frontiers, as well as to, for example, extend patents beyond the 20-year patents for drug monopolies, which is what is the agreed to international standard currently under the World Trade Organization. They want to extend that. They want to be able to actually extend those monopolies even further than has been negotiated in the past. So the idea, they keep calling this ambitious. They want all sectors to be covered. They don't want there to be any exceptions. And so this is a way to really try to cement this model that we would argue has actually shown that it has been a failure in NAFTA, but to actually expand it instead of to rethink it, to learn from the lessons of the past, and to try to actually promote a fairer trading model.
Finally, Melinda, how likely is it that the Trans-Pacific Partnership will succeed? It's not clear if China will join, and supposedly Japan is not very happy about the idea of joining either. Will it go ahead if there's just a few countries, or will it fall apart unless everybody joins?
Well, I mean, I think that remains to be seen. What's very clear is that despite the intent for the talks to have concluded far before now, and then most recently they had been the U.S. Trade Representative been saying they wanted to conclude them at the end of this year. Already they're talking about it going far into 2013. There's a lot of controversy at the negotiating table. That's part of why Lori was being pulled out as she began, and on many different issues. And it is quite complex. there are and citizens around in TPP countries are standing up and saying this isn't the type of agreement that we want. And so we very much believe that this is not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination. And it's now that folks should get involved to get educated about it and to really stand up, because unfortunately in many of the areas, it's actually the U.S. government that's playing a very extremist role in pushing some of the most extreme corporate centered proposals. And it's time for people now to stand up and to learn about it and to get mobilized.
Give out a website for Global Trade Watch.
There is, in order to learn about TPP, I encourage folks to visit www.tpp2012.com, and that will take you to the part of our website that talks specifically about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and has opportunities to take action.
TPP2012.com. We'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Melinda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Melinda St. Louis is the campaign director at Global Trade Watch, and we've been talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at a new documentary coming to theaters this week called Five Broken Cameras. And later in the hour, the author of a new book called The Big Squeeze, a social and political history of the controversial mammogram, will join us. Stay tuned.
This is Summer Reese, Interim Executive Director of the Pacifica Foundation and Chair of the Pacifica National Board. I'd like to invite you to participate in your radio station by becoming a candidate for the local station board. Pacifica is the first and only truly listener-supported radio network in the country. We are the other public radio made possible by you. We depend on our many listeners and volunteers to make this incredible radio station the unique voice that it is in the community. A great way to support your station is to become a member of the local station board, where many of the important decisions about your radio station are made. The great news is that we have extended the deadline to become a candidate to September 13th, 2012. So, if you've been thinking about becoming a candidate, now is the time. We need your skills, energy, and talent to make us better than ever. It's easy, too. To get all the details and become involved at a whole new level, just go to your station's website, where you can contact your local election supervisor, get the information you need, and sign up to be a candidate. Remember, you now have until September 13th, 2012. So please, join us and help take your radio station into the future.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thousands of Palestinians protested against the high cost of living in the West Bank city of Hebron this past Monday, angry over rising prices and the government's inability to pay full salaries. Much of the rage is directed at Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, whom Lebanon's Daily Star describes as, quote, a U.S.-educated economist who oversees the government's finances. The high cost of living was a central point at this past week's cabinet meeting chaired by Fayyad, who says the troubles are beyond his control and has even offered to roll back planned tax increases as a concession. A new United Nations report late last week links the high level of Palestinian poverty to Israeli policies and the recent cutting off of international aid by other nations in solidarity with Israel. Now, a new documentary collaboration between Palestinian filmmaker Imad Barnat and Israeli filmmaker Guy Davidi documents the day-to-day effects of the Israeli occupation, specifically in the West Bank village of Bilin. It tells the story through the lens of a series of video cameras and the youthful eyes of Imad Barnat's newborn son, Gabriel. The eye-opening and powerful documentary, filmed through five cameras that end up destroyed under various dangerous circumstances, is called simply Five Broken Cameras, and it opens at the Lumley Theatres this week. Imad Barnat begins the film by following the nonviolent struggles led by two of his friends, but the subsequent events begin to affect his family and his own life as he witnesses and documents daily arrests, violent attacks, night raids, the burning of his family's olive trees, and the excessive use of Israeli military force. The footage depicts an unsettlingly realistic perspective of the violence in Berlin, where active protests take place daily, and the Israeli occupation continues to consolidate control. Joining me on the phone now from Israel is Guy Davidi, the co-director of Five Broken Cameras. Welcome to Uprising, Guy.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. And sadly, Imad Barnat himself couldn't join us. He's currently at a screening of his film in Ramallah. Well, Guy, how important is it for particularly Americans to see this film? And it's not a conventional film. It's a documentary that wasn't really planned, was it?
What we tried to do with this film when we create the time of the month of
coming. We're going to have to call you back, Guy. We're having trouble hearing you, and we'll try to get you on a better line. We're speaking to him live from Israel, and so the phone is a little bit difficult, but we are trying to talk to him about this documentary called Five Broken Cameras that was filmed on literally five cameras, one after the other, by Palestinian cameraman Imad Barnat, a farmer in the West Bank city, West Bank village of Belin, who begins to start his journey by filming his newborn fourth son, Gibril. And as his son grows older, he witnesses the ongoing effects of the Israeli occupation in his village, as well as the encroaching so-called separation wall that ends up taking vast tracts of Palestinian lands and essentially giving it away to Israeli settlers. The film is opening this week on September 14th at the Lemley Theaters. It's called Five Broken Cameras, and we will try to give you more information about where you can watch that. Guy Davidi, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, so let's start over. The film is very unconventional, and I understand it wasn't really even a planned documentary, because Imad Barnat simply began by filming his youngest son, Gibril, and then it turned into something much more.
Yes. Originally, Imad didn't think to make a film. So he was filming for many years to use the footage and to put it in YouTube and to inform people about the movement, the nonviolent movement in his village, and also to use the footage in court as a kind of an evidence to show always, because the army tries to show sometimes that people are using violence, and the camera are the only evidence that we have to prove that actually this is not the reality. So for many years he was filming without thinking this would be a film, and his son and his family was something he filmed as a father, like every father with a camera is doing. He didn't think this would be part of the film. And then in 2009, after 4 years that he was filming, he approached me and he offered me, let's make a film. And I actually thought that making a film from just the demonstration and just the violent events that's happening in the village is not enough. And we found all this beautiful material, all this personal family story, and created the story out of this footage as well.
Now, how did you arrive at the decision to tell the story in chapters along with the cameras that Imad used? Literally, each camera tells its own chapter, if you will, in the story.
Yes, I was, since I'm doing, I'm occupied with video and cinema and teaching as well, then throughout the years, I always received emails from Imad and from other people that were looking, doing some fundraising to find the finance to buy Imad another camera. So I got this email from time to time. And when, in 2009, when Imad told me let's do a film together, I asked him, I remember you had so many cameras and you lost several of them. So how many did you have in total? So he told me, yeah, I had counted. And he said, yeah, I think I had totally five cameras. And I asked him whether all these cameras that were broken, was it filmed? And he told me that these were always, the situation were always filmed. So then came the idea to create the structure, because this is a good metaphor of resistance. This is a story of resistance, and the fact that another camera is broken and then he gets a new camera and then another camera is broken and gets a new. This is a bit the life of Palestinians and the life of the resisting the occupation, because you always have difficulties and you suffer and you continue on and on. And for me, it's also a metaphor about making a film in general and the difficulties that you have to confront with, and every time you find new solutions to create the film.
Now, Guy, the footage that is in the film shows remarkable nonviolent protests, Palestinians taking up, you know, musical instruments, carrying signs, chaining themselves to the separation wall as it's being built, alongside even international solidarity activists who come and share some of their creative protest techniques. It's a different picture than we get here in the media about the violence of the Palestinian resistance.
Yes, but this is reality that existed for many years in the West Bank. nonviolent movement is not just something new that just is happening now and we document it as if it is something fresh. And this is something that was happening for many years. The ability and the fact that more cameras are more accessible to people just allow us to document and to have a different approach and different narrative to these events. But these events, this nonviolent movement is an ongoing one from the 80s, at least that I know of, and probably much before as well.
Did the camera offer Imad Bernat a sort of a level of protection, because he was able to get so close to so many scenes of danger, particularly when his brothers and his friends were confronting members of the Israeli Defense Forces?
I think sometimes the camera can be used to many things to Imad. I think sometimes it gives a sense of protection, not always a real protection. Sometimes it is real protection, but sometimes it's a ticking bomb, because once you take the camera and you're going out to the events, you put yourself at risk. And sometimes the journalist, and especially if people know Imad and they know that he's part of the village, then he becomes a target himself. So it's not always a protection, but it's true that while in all this violent situation, and these are very emotional situations, because all the people that we see that are demonstrating or getting shot, they are Imad's friends and Imad's neighbors and Imad's family. So it gives kind of a sense of an emotional protection, because you put yourself outside a bit of the events, and it gives you also kind of a purpose. Which other people who don't hold cameras sometimes can lose more easily. So I think it's more about that than about the actual protection.
Now, the film is also about how children in the occupied territories are affected, because you literally watch his baby, his fourth son, Gabriel, from when he's a newborn and growing up. And in the camera, through the camera, Imad Bernat, the cameraman, your co-director of this film, Five Broken Cameras, I think starts to reconsider how children view this occupation, how they watch what happens in front of them, and maybe sometimes the invisible traumas that they might be inflicted by.
Yeah. I think what is funny about the film and the footage is that this point of view of Jibril came up from the footage itself. I don't think Imad really noticed throughout the years how much these situations are not normal, because this is the normal life of many Palestinian villagers and children. So actually, I think this was part of my contribution to the film, because for me as an Israeli, I had a complete different kind of childhood. I didn't grow up with soldiers and with violence around me. So for me, when I looked at this footage, I thought, hey, there is something going on here, and the kid is growing into something, and this is important, and there's a very interesting and strong point of view. But for Imad, actually, this was normal, because this is also his childhood. So we had to relook on the footage. He had to look at the footage in a new eye, in an eye that's says, hey, wait, this childhood, this is not normal for the kid to live around in this surrounding.
And actually, on that issue then, let's talk about your contribution to this documentary. Do you think that viewing it as somebody who isn't experiencing the occupation firsthand, you were able to find these themes that perhaps Palestinians, because they've lived this all their lives, may take for granted and may not even realize is something unusual, something very difficult, and something that's not an ordinary experience for most human beings?
Of course, but not only that, I would say also that because this is a movement, a community movement, it's a movement of a village and of several villages, and also it's a movement, a national movement. So it was very hard for Imad to accept and to agree to tell the story from a personal perspective and to go into all these intimate details of his life and show his family and his wife and all the internal relations in the family that are results of what is happening outside. So for him, it was a very difficult, because because you said, what are my neighbors are going to say? I took all this historical events to tell my story in it, and so my role, one of my main role in the film was to encourage him to show himself more and to expose himself and to tell the story in such a way that mixes between what's personal and what is intimate and what is external and social and this big historical event.
How does this film stand out within the pantheon of documentaries that have covered the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian lands and territories? I mean, this is a topic that endless documentaries have been made about. How is this one different?
Yes, the first, when first Imad offered me to do the film, my first reaction was, is there another reason to make another film about the same subject? So, but I thought that the fact that he filmed throughout so many years, he filmed 5 years and he filmed after I joined the project as well, 2 more years. So was covering six and a half years of this big historical movement that is very important in Israel and Palestine and is very known in the world. And the fact that all of this historical events, Imad allowed us throughout these events to show a very intimate moment that we've never seen in Palestinian films, from a Palestinian point of view, from a villager's point of view also. He's not coming from a cinema background, filmmaking background. He's a character, part of the village. So it gives us a very intimate look of what the result of the occupation. And also, films are not just about the footage itself and the events. It's also about the storytelling. And what we really try to achieve in this film is also to find the right emotional tone in which we didn't want to accuse Israelis or to accuse the soldiers, to put the blame on anyone. So as a viewer, even if you're coming from not the opinion, the left liberal opinion in Israel or in any other place, and watch the film, you don't feel accused. And you don't also feel that there is an idealization to the other side, to the Palestinian, because we didn't try to let people feel pity towards Palestinian and their suffering. So the idea was to kind of find a new emotional pattern, a new emotional trip, I would say, throughout the film. And this is what makes the film fresh and new, I think, for all audiences, even audiences that are much more used to watch these kind of films. Mm. Not just their audience that rarely watch this kind of film, but we say this kind of film.
Well, finally, Guy Davidi, has there been a response in Israel? Has the film been viewed in Israel?
Yes, this is actually quite a big success in Israel as well. We had the Israeli television of Channel 8 that showed the film, and they really love it. They show it in many reruns in these days as well. And the film also participated at the Jerusalem Film Festival, where it got the Best Documentary Award, so it got a lot of recognition as well. In that sense, and it's going out as well in theatrical release in Israel. So there's been a good reaction to the audience. Of course, we have still a long way to do, because we have to get the film to be shown in communities and in places where people are not naturally going to see documentaries, political documentaries dealing with this kind of subject. So there is a challenge, of course, that lies beyond showing the film in festivals and in small cinemas.
Well, Guy Davidi, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and wish you and your co-director, Imad Bernat, the best of luck with this documentary. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Guy Davidi is the co-director of the documentary Five Broken Cameras. And Imad Bernat, co-director and cameraman of Five Broken Cameras, was not able to join us. He's currently at a screening of his film in Ramallah. The film is opening on September 14th at Lemley's Monica Fourplex in Santa Monica. That's at 1332 2nd Street in Santa Monica. The film was reviewed favorably by the New York Times, among many other publications. The New York Times called it a chronicle of protest and endurance violence, punctuated by violence and tiny glimmers of hope. For anyone who retains an interest in the human contours of the situation, the movie is necessary if difficult viewing. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at a new book called The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Stay tuned. And that's Muda Kare by Zing Experience, a roots reggae rock band from New York City. You can find out more about them online at zingexperience.com or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A new study published last Thursday has found that the standard tool used to detect breast cancer mammograms, may actually increase the risk of breast cancer in some young women who are already susceptible to the disease. The study examined 2,000 women and found that those who were under the age of 30 and carried the BRCA breast cancer genes increased their risk of developing breast cancer dramatically through the use of diagnostic mammograms and other chest x-rays. According to an ABC News report on the study, quote, if all carriers of the gene had one mammogram before age 30, the number developing breast cancer by age 40 would rise from 9 to 14 out of every 100. The recommendation by the American Cancer Society for women under 30 who have the breast cancer genes is to get yearly screening mammograms, but in Europe, such women are advised to get screened through the use of MRIs instead. Now, a new book by breast radiologist Handel Reynolds, who formerly was at Indiana University and currently is at a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, questions the wisdom of the widespread use of mammography. Published by Cornell University Press, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram, delves into the history of the tool, its adoption as an effective tool in the fight against breast cancer, the many industries it has spawned in medical equipment, and what the benefits and risks of mammography are. Handel Reynolds now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you so very much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, let's discuss this new study that just came out that is certainly concerning. It's not terribly new. There has been suspicion and fear among women before that subjecting a sensitive part of your body to radiation, couldn't that increase the risk of the disease that you're trying to protect yourself from?
Right. So first thing we should make clear is that this applies to a very small segment of the population. This study applies to women who are genetically predisposed to breast cancer, women who have mutations in the BRCA, BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes, which probably is no more than about 1 to 2% of the general population. Now, these women are at exceedingly high risk of breast cancer. Up to 60 or 70% of them will develop breast cancer in their lifetime. And what the researchers found is that because these breasts are so susceptible to breast cancer, that if these women are exposed to radiation prior to the age of 30, that they significantly increase their risk of breast cancer. So the risk went up quite significantly, whether it was mammography or chest x-rays or any type of radiation prior to the age of 30. They found no increased risk of breast cancer among these women if they were exposed after the age of 30. Now, this is important because traditionally we've encouraged such women to undergo rather intensive screening to look for breast cancer because they're at such high risk. currently, the American Cancer Society recommends that these women undergo a multi-layered approach with mammography and MRI. And based on this information, we would certainly say that they should not start having mammograms before age 30, but they should start having MRIs perhaps as early as age 25. And then once they hit 30 and beyond, we would advise mammography and MRI on an annual basis for these women. But bear in mind, this only applies to women who are gene positive for these extremely high-risk genes, and so it does not apply to the vast majority of the population. Now, let me give you a little context in terms of the amount of radiation that is applied during a mammogram. So when a woman undergoes a mammogram, the amount of radiation she's exposed to is equivalent approximately to about 7 weeks of naturally occurring background radiation. So as we walk around on planet Earth, we are subject to a variety of natural sources of radiation, such as cosmic radiation coming from outer space, depending on where you live, radon gas, and a mammogram is equivalent to about 7 weeks of your annual dosage of natural radiation. So it's a very small amount, and in a normal risk woman, a woman who is not gene positive, the risk of developing a breast cancer from mammography is incredibly low.
So let's talk about the adoption of this tool. And historically, in the 70s, when this was becoming, when the use of the mammogram became extremely popular, you write about this history and how this tool became popular at a time when it was very important for politicians to be seen as doing something about cancer, particularly about cancer and women's health.
Mammography has been politicized for many decades, quite honestly. And in fact, the birth of mammography in the early 1970s was significantly aided by a major piece of legislation known as the National Cancer Act, signed by President Nixon early in the 1970s, that provided huge sums of money for cancer control programs. And it was these funds in the early 1970s that significantly aided the rollout of this new screening tool starting around 1973. Now, as far as the politicization of this this test, we're all familiar with the 2009 episode where the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force rescinded its previous recommendation for screening among women 40 to 49 and the huge uproar that caused in the midst of the debate over the Affordable Care Act. Your audience might be intrigued to know that this was not the first time such a scenario had played out. In fact, in 1993, the National Cancer Institute dropped its recommendation for screening women under 50. And there was similar uproar because this occurred during the debate over President Clinton's Health Security Act, or his attempt at healthcare reform. And so the same scenario that we saw in the recent episode in 2009 actually played out some decades earlier. And this business of mammography screening, particularly women under 50, has been highly politicized almost from the word go.
Now, what about the industries that have been spawned from the use, the widespread use of mammography? You note in your book that initially mammograms were simply done by regular X-ray machines.
Yes. So early on, in the 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s, a lot of mammography was performed on what we call general-purpose X-ray equipment. So this would be an X-ray machine that might be used to X-ray a broken bone, for example. It wasn't until sort of in the mid-70s that we started to see the adoption of dedicated mammography units that look like the ones we use today, where there is a compression paddle and the breast is compressed for a period of time, and the image is taken. Since then, we've had significant evolutions in this technology, going from the old-fashioned film mammogram to about 10 years ago now, the digital mammogram. And here lately, we've gone another step further into the 3D mammogram realm.
And this is a pretty big moneymaker?
Well, you know, mammography itself is not a moneymaker per se for the providers, because as a screening test, the Medicare reimbursement rate set by Congress is kept relatively low so as not to affect access to the technology. So, you know, mammography itself is not a moneymaker per se for the providers. In fact, there are lots of mammography facilities that barely break even. But, of course, mammography is tied up together with a whole corollary economy built around breast cancer and other tools for finding breast cancer and the breast cancer awareness pink ribbon movement. All of that is tied together. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, all of that is sustained by ongoing aggressive mammography screening.
Now, how is the mammogram been treated? How is it that it's sort of become a more of a silver bullet to detect cancer, and that sometimes women actually think that getting yearly mammograms or regular mammograms may actually prevent breast cancer?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. There is a high degree of confusion. In fact, there was a survey about 5-6 years ago that found that over 50% of women held the notion that mammography was preventive. Now, we need to make it clear that mammography is a screening tool. It does not prevent breast cancer. It is designed to find it early. In fact, I saw an article online on the Jezebel.com site just a couple days ago. The article entitled, I'll just read it, "Great, Breast Cancer Prevention May Lead to Breast Cancer." And it's talking about the same study we just discussed, but they use the word prevention referring to mammography. So there's widespread misconception about what mammography does.
And so when women who find cancers who get regular mammograms, often they are shocked that they would actually get breast cancer because they've sort of followed the rules.
Exactly. And we find this quite frequently. When I speak to patients because I find an abnormality on a mammogram and subsequently it's found to be breast cancer, many women are quite shocked, you know, and they'll say things like, but I have my mammogram every year. And you know, we have to spend a few minutes discussing, you know, the difference between early detection and prevention. So, you know, let me summarize kind of what we know about what mammography does. Mm-hmm. Mammography is an important tool in the fight against breast cancer, and it's a tool that will continue to be available to all women. We know that women who are screened will reduce their risk of dying of breast cancer. That magnitude of benefit varies by age, so older women experience a more significant reduction in their risk of dying than younger women. We also know that mammography has certain risks or harms, such as false positives, false negatives, and overdiagnosis. Some of those risks are more common in younger women. And that is the reason why we've always argued about the younger population, because the benefit is somewhat smaller and some of the risks are somewhat greater. So that risk-benefit ratio actually improves as women get older. And, you know, we've been arguing about these younger women where it's more of a close call as to whether it's the right thing to do or not.
And it's also very confusing for women when the recommendations change over time, and also when sometimes the recommendations don't change or stay the same because of political considerations. I understand earlier this year, for example, the recommendations for pap smears changed from doing it every once a year to once every 3 years, and that there's actually no difference in detecting certain ovarian cancers. What is the current recommendation? You mentioned earlier for women who carry the BRCA genes, the ACS, the American Cancer Society, recommends yearly mammograms. What about for ordinary women who don't necessarily carry that gene?
Right. So currently, the American Cancer Society recommends annual mammography starting at age 40. And I guess to kind of piggyback on your original statement just a few moments ago, you're absolutely right. We have employed an approach to mammography promotion over the past several decades that I would characterize as the just-do-it approach. Basically, we've traditionally just told women, you know, mammography is good for you, you should just do it. We have really not talked about the full story. We've highlighted the benefits without necessarily discussing the harms or potential risks. And what I feel is that this has done women a disservice, and I believe that modern women are better served by a full and open discussion of mammography's benefits and potential risks, because all screening tests have some potential downsides. So I believe the better approach is informed decision-making, and that's what I hope to achieve with this book, is to give women the whole story, all of the information, so they can talk it through with their doctors and hopefully be empowered to make the right choice for them. So having received all the information, a woman may choose to begin screening at 40. That's quite reasonable, quite rational. A woman may choose to wait till she's 50. That's also quite reasonable. And quite frankly, there will be a small percentage of women who, having been totally informed of the issues, will choose not to be screened. And I think we need to respect all of those decisions.
You mentioned earlier overdiagnosis. What is that and why is it dangerous?
Yes, so overdiagnosis is a potential consequence of screening for any cancer. And the bottom line is that some cancers that are found when we go hunting for cancer are things that would not have become evident in the person's lifetime if we were not looking so hard. Now, this occurs quite commonly with breast and prostate cancer screening. Now, we don't know the full extent of it. We can't say exactly how often it occurs, but some studies have suggested that up to a third of breast cancers that are found at routine screening could be overdiagnosis. Now, there's no way to know which ones are and which ones aren't, and so all patients who have breast cancer are treated. Now, in the book, I talk about one specific type of breast cancer that is very susceptible to this overdiagnosis problem. And if I could take a minute just to drill down a little bit, it's known as DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, or stage zero breast cancer. And this is where the cancer is completely within the milk ducts. There's no lump. There's no pain. It's completely asymptomatic. Now, before mammography, it constituted about 1 or 2% of breast cancers. Now, in the era of mammography, it constitutes up to 25% of breast cancers. And the reason for that is very simple. This type of breast cancer, or this stage of breast cancer, is very easily found in mammography. It shows up as little white dots. We call them microcalcifications. And so now that we're doing mammograms, we find lots and lots of these DCIS lesions. About 50,000 women a year are diagnosed with this condition. Now, you may ask, what's the matter with that? That's great. We're finding all this early cancer. The potential problem is that we know that not all of these DCIS lesions that we're finding would ever have amounted to anything, because a cancer that stays in that stage cannot kill. It's non-lethal. And only about a third to a half of those cancers would progress to the next level, what we call invasive cancer, and could potentially be lethal. So at the present time, we believe a good chunk of the women who are diagnosed with DCIS today as a result of screening could potentially represent overdiagnosis.
Well, Dr. Handel Reynolds, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome. It was my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Handel Reynolds is a breast radiologist currently in a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, formerly chief of radiology at Indiana University. We've been talking about his book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram, published by Cornell University Press. And for Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, George Washington once said, truth will ultimately prevail where there are pains to bring it to light. You've been listening to Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our assistant producer. Dave Samek is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, and our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.